The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hello. How is everybody today? Everybody seems so far away, actually, with this row of seats. But my name's David Hunter. I'm an assistant professor of law here and have taught in the program for more than half of the 25 years of the ILSP program. So I've started teaching in 1993. And I'm very happy to be here as part of the celebration. This panel is highlighting the ongoing dispute between Argentina and Uruguay involving two proposed pulp mills near the border of Argentina, but located in Uruguay. And when we were thinking about putting together this panel, we thought of it as not only a panel to discuss the what is a relatively rare occurrence, an international environmental dispute that has made it to the World Court, which in itself would make it topical, but also in some ways a case study or a model of some of the modern international environmental issues around investment, and also of the kinds of advocacy and law questions and new fora that come to play in ways that one wouldn't even have imagined when this ILSP program was started 25 years ago. Namely, fora like the International Finance Corporation's Compliance Advisor and Ombudsman, the CAO, an institution that was created in 1999, as well as use of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights for issues relating to the environment, again, a development that one might not have been able to imagine 25 years ago. And so, as well, the kind of leadership role that civil society has played in developing this case, particularly the Centro de Derechos Humanos y Ambiental, CEDA, the Center for Environment and Human Rights in Argentina, which has been deeply involved in developing some of the legal theories and advocacy strategies around this case and really pushing this in new fora. And I think we'll get into some of those issues as well today. So I think we can both learn about the very specific conflict in front of the World Court as well as explore some of these broader issues, both legal issues and what this portends for challenges to international investment in an era of sustainable development in the future. Because this case really does highlight issues of bringing in technologies that may or may not have been allowed in the host country of the European Union, the idea of bringing such technologies into developing countries that want the technologies and want the investment, but that might be bringing environmental impacts that might not be tolerated any longer in the home country. So what does that say about the future of investment and of environmental disputes as well? All right, enough from me. I'm only moderating. So let me introduce the panel. I'm going to introduce the three of them now, and then not in terms of when they're speaking, but I'll do it in the order that they're going to speak. First, Juan Carlos Blanco will be speaking. Juan Carlos is a founding partner of Blanco and Echeverri, a law firm specializing in corporate law, trade, and investment in Montevideo, Uruguay. And he's an alumni of the program in 1999. He will be followed by Eugenia Beck, who is a graduate of the program as well in 1993, and I might add a graduate of my very first class I ever taught, so it's an old home week for me. And is a founding partner of the law firm and consulting firm Estudio Beck in Buenos Aires, Argentina, a law firm that specializes in environmental law. and I think the first law firm in Argentina to specialize in environmental law in that way. And then they will be followed by Marcos Orellana, who's a senior attorney at the Center for International Environmental Law, also an alum of the program and graduating in 1999, and currently a member of the SJD program, getting his working on his thesis. How's that going, Marcos? Oh, never mind. We'll talk about that later. Marcos works on a wide range of human rights and international trade and investment issues at the Center for International Environmental Law, CL, as we call it, and teaches here in an adjunct capacity as well. His current course is, in fact, investment, trade, and human rights law, and he also teaches a course on the law of the sea. So without any further, I will hand the microphone over to Juan Carlos.
Thank you. Hello.
Yes. First of all, thank you to all of you for coming here, and thank you for the university for inviting me. This is a very good opportunity for me to come and talk about Uruguay. It's a little country, but this is a big conflict for us. So let's go directly to the problem. Okay. Let's talk about geography first. Some of you don't know where Uruguay is. As you see, it's in the south cone of South America between Argentina and Brazil, two big countries. The capital of Uruguay is Montevideo. You can see there. Now it's a larger map of the country. And here we have the river that is in dispute is this big river, okay, that goes out to the Rio de la Plata. It's called the Uruguay River. And it's the border, a natural border between Argentina here and Uruguay on this side. The only three connecting bridges within the two countries are these three that you see there. Okay? And specifically, the problem that we are seeing today, you're seeing it here, and there are two different cities, little towns on either side of the border, okay? In Uruguay you have Fray Bentos, and in Argentina you have Gualeguaychú. And now going directly, this is an excellent picture from Google. Thank you, Google. Here you have, yes, it's in another panel, no? Okay. Here you have the bridge, that's the San Martin Bridge, or the Artigas Bridge, depending on which side you are. This is Uruguayan side. This is one of the plants that is being constructed today. It's the Botnia plant, okay? And this is the town of Fray Bentos in Uruguay. You cannot see the town of Gualeguaychú because it's far away, some kilometers. No, it's like, what, 5 kilometers? Yes, okay. It's further, but it's near, but it's not in the picture. This is another good picture, an overview of the place. As you can see, the investment is huge. It's a very, very, very big plant, and especially for Uruguay, okay, it's a little economy. So for Uruguay, it's really a very important investment. Okay, this is something about Uruguay. We are 3.3 million people, so it's a little country area, more or less, roughly between Argentina and Uruguay and Brazil. It's a little, compared with them, it's a little country. But Spanish, Montevideo, and it's like, that's not very important, just for you to know. Going about to environmental aspects of the thing. Uruguay is known to be very strict with environmental issues. In the world, and also in, especially in Latin America. This is a sustainability ranking of 2005. You can see Uruguay is 6th. And we really have very strict laws that we're going to see now. They were followed, at least that's my opinion, in these two projects, But there you see Argentina, and also just for reference, Uruguay is 45th. These are the two. The all of this is about these two projects. There are two big pulp mill projects. One of Botnia is of Finnish origin, and the other is Ence of Spain, Spanish origin. Okay, and the important thing, that's why I talked about the little country, because in the balance that you have to have between the investment and the environmental sustainability, obviously it's important the investment of the project. If you can see, it's 1.2 billion, that for Uruguay is really huge investment, and also plus 600 million of ends. And also, of course, the workers there are going to are working now in Botnia, because ENCE didn't start yet the construction of the pulp mill. And after they finish, 300 workers are going to work at the Botnia plant, and 180 in ENCE. This is another picture with colors. Okay, so how did all started? Let me give you a context. In 2002, Uruguay suffered like an enormous economic crisis, like banks shut down. It was really, really a bad year for Uruguay. So in those years, that the government needed something to recover economically, these two companies came to Uruguay and said that they wanted to. They had a project of to install two pulp mills on the river. After doing all the paperwork, finally, the Uruguayan government gave the authorization. At that point, citizens of Gualeguaychú, as you saw, it was the Argentinian town on the other side of the river, started a social movement against the construction. As all this type of things start, like they were going to the press, there were a little thing here, you saw them at the beginning very little in the press, very little articles, but then the movement started to grow and grow. Then they created what was until now, at least it's, for me, it was a very creative thing. The Gualeguaychú meeting. It's like a popular assembly, and they meet every day, but when I mean say every day, they meet every day since what, a year and a half, more or less. Every night they go there and they talk about the issues on the pollution, the potential pollution of the plants, etc., etc. Then also Greenpeace and other groups, Action, also contributed to all those movements, and when those movements got bigger, they got the attention of first of the state government of Entre Ríos, first of the mayor of Gualeguaychú, then the governor of the state of Entre Ríos, where Gualeguaychú is located, and finally the federal government supported also the meeting. President Kirchner of Argentina was there in Gualeguaychú making a speech. I don't know if he was really in favor of the two pulp mills, but sorry, against the two pulp mills, but yes, supporting the Gualeguaychú meeting. So until now, there was no problem for Uruguay, because it was all speeches, one government saying something, Uruguay saying another thing, but no problem, no consequences until that moment. But what happened? The main action of the Gualeguaychú meeting was to blockade the route that, and thus the bridge that connects Argentina and Uruguay. So that had like a real, real impact in all Uruguay. For example, let's take my case. I read in the newspaper, yes, there was a problem of the mills, but until this happened, we thought, okay, it's a problem that politicians are going to arrange someday, and that's it. This is the bridge the day, the first march, they did it over the bridge. Okay. Yeah. There you can read, si a la vida, no, yes to life, no to the pulp mills. I don't know here which side is San Martin Bridge. Okay. This is the one that is continuous is this route blockade. This is an international route, no? So you come from the route and you go, you cross the river and you continue the route. As you can see, this is the Gualeguaychú meeting, on the blockade. The blockade, sometimes in the high season, the summer season, it's permanent. So people cannot go to from Argentina to Uruguay, especially, because a lot of Argentinians go to Uruguay in the summer season to the beaches in Uruguay. So that's the Gualeguaychú meeting in action. This is another protest. This is very common. It's like every week or like. This is the final. This is the most famous picture of the conflict. I don't know if you. This was in 2005. It was the summit of all presidents in Vienna. You can see there is Vicente Fox from Spain, Zapatero. This is Lula from Brazil. There's Tony Blair laughing there. And this is the queen. The queen of the carnival of Gualeguaychú. Really. So she won like a contest there. And then this is like a media. It was excellent as a media production. I don't know what this guy is doing. I don't know if he wants to get her or take her away. I don't know. And also another interesting thing is that you have there the second. This guy, no, the one that is on top of that is the Uruguayan president, Tabaré Vázquez, and behind this girl is Kirchner from Argentina. Okay, so we don't know his face at that moment. And with this picture, it all exploded in Uruguay, in Argentina, in all the world, because we all knew what was going on. Or at least you ask, if you see this picture, say, what is going on? Okay, so what were the consequences of such blockade? I'm always talking on the Uruguay point of view, okay? It affected the free circulation of people, of goods, and of services. And the three main sectors that were affected were tourism, commerce, and transportation. Now we're going to talk about tourism because it's very important, the blockade in that aspect. What they managed to do, the Gualeguaychú meeting, you remember you saw in the big picture of Uruguay, in the big map, there were three bridges, okay, and the blockade was just in one bridge, but they managed to support other groups that were in the other bridges, in the other two bridges. So there was an extension of the blockade to the other two bridges. And in some days, you could not go from Uruguay to Argentina or vice versa. You cannot do it. It was a total blockade. And the most important achievement this movement done is that at one point last year, ENCE says, no, this is too much. We are going to have problems from here until, I don't know, 10 years or a whole life. So they decide to relocate its plants. And ENCE went downstream to a place that there's no Argentinian town on the other side. And the river is very open there. So there's no problem. This is just to tell you about the tourism industry in Uruguay that is, The important thing is here, there were 45,000 people, tourists less than in 2006, because it's very near the beaches in Uruguay for Argentina. So most of the people come from Buenos Aires, they take the bridge and they cross to the beaches. And so that's a very, very economic, great economic impact we suffered until now, because now also the thing is that, for example, now is Holy Week in 1 week in both countries, and the whole week is going to be blocked, the Uruguay and the bridge, the San Martin bridge. Okay, going to international applicable law, there is a specific River Uruguay Boundary Treaty that was entered into force in 1966, and also a River Uruguay Statute that was entered into force in 1976. And let me talk a little bit about local law. As I said, Uruguay has very strict laws for environmental laws. And what applies in this case, what it did apply is Decree 249 of 2005. And we are going to see now, like, I want you to know more or less when you have a project in Uruguay, you first start with a communication of the project to the ministry. There is a ministry of environment, and that is giving you an impression of the importance that environment has to Uruguay. Then the ministry classifies the project in these three categories, starting with the non-significant impact until C. Obviously, both plants are in C category. Okay. And after that, when the government says, okay, it's C category, the companies have to file the most important document with all the project, all the impact, the ratios of pollution, everything it goes in the environmental impact study. Okay, both companies did that. Then the government gives, after having the project of from the companies, they do like a summarized environmental report that they put it in the it's open to the public. Okay, so there is a public hearing. In these two cases, there were two public hearings where all people can go. The Gualeguaychú meeting also went there. I don't know if the Gualeguaychú people from Gualeguaychú, the Gualeguaychú meeting was not created yet at that moment. And then finally, and also everyone can file what they want in writing. So lots of people did that also. And after having all that information, the government releases the authorization that is called prior environmental authorization. And it was granted to ENCE in 2003 and to Botnia in 2005. But that's not all, because after the environmental authorization, there is a strict environmental management plan for the construction and operation. So nowadays, all the time, they have to file reports to the Ministry of Environment saying what they have done, and the government can make some corrections if they understand that they are appropriate. Just to tell you, the Botnia plant is under construction. It's going very fast. It was the one that you saw in the picture. But the ENCE never started, and now it's going to start, I don't know, this year, I think. They have the place already, and this year they're going to start. This is very quick, because my colleagues are going to talk about these problems. There were two procedures, and two arbitration procedures. One in the International Court of Justice. The final judgment is underway. I think that not this year, maybe next year we will have it, 2008. And both countries seek preparational measures that were rejected. We're going to see that now. And also, there was an called by Uruguay, there was an arbitral tribunal of Mercosur. Mercosur is an economic bloc like the European Union in Europe. Well, we have like, it's Uruguay, Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Venezuela now joined the bloc. And also Chile and Bolivia are like associate members, yes, but not full members. Huh? Yeah. So what happened was that in May 2006, Argentina started proceedings against Uruguay, claiming the breach of the Uruguayan River Statute. Uruguay River Statute. That's the final judgment is pending. And the important thing for Argentina was that Uruguay immediately stopped the construction of the plants, because if not, it was from Argentina point of view, it's very difficult. I understand it. It's very difficult for them to think that someone is going to stop the operation of the plant if the construction went all the way. So they request the indication of provisional measures for the suspension authorization and authorization on building works. That was rejected. 14-1, 14 judges in favor of the rejection and one in favor of the Argentina position. And what happened then? That was very curious, because Uruguay thought that because of that, because it was 14-1, they weren't going to give us anything we asked. So the important thing to Uruguay is the blockade. So immediately we ask the same, and we file a petition here, for the indication of provisional measures to prevent an end bridge blockades. We did the opposite after that rejection. And we all in Uruguay, I can tell, and we all thought that the court was going to say yes to our petition, and it was the same again. It was 14-1 rejected. In both cases, the only judge that voted in favor was the arbiter of the country that lost. No, in this case, in Argentina, and this in Uruguay. So we can say that there was unanimity, no? Because okay, more or less. And then also in the Mercosur Arbitral Tribunal, Uruguay requested the tribunal to say that Argentina must adopt the appropriate measure to prevent or stop blockades. That's the important thing to Uruguay, was to stop blockades and to guarantee the free traffic between countries. And here is, as we can see, Mercosur is not working, because this is very funny. In point number one, they say, okay, Uruguay is right, you are correct, what your brother did is bad, say that the blockades are not compatible with the commitment assumed by parties in Mercosur. And then in point two it says, okay, but I can do nothing about it. Okay? So as we can see, this jurisdiction is kind of useless, at least at this point. Well, this is one of the possible solutions. I don't know, maybe it's the only one. What happened? As you know, Uruguay and Argentina have historic close ties with Spain. Spain is very respected in both countries, and also the figure of the king is very respected. So the king, when he saw what was going on between these two countries, he said, okay, I'm going to mediate between both of you. And obviously the two countries said, okay, there's no problem. And they started trilateral negotiations. But until now, nothing has happened. I think the escalation is going up. And both parties now, the other day I read that they decided to meet again on April 18 and 20 in Madrid, in Spain. So, yes, we hope this mediation brings a solution, because it's very, very difficult, as I will say now in the conclusions, to have a solution on this issue. So, just to share with you some thoughts, for me, it was, I'm so naive, but I discovered that political interests here are like incredible, how they meddle in this problems. Okay. Uruguayan government says, okay, I'm correct. And the Argentinian government is not doing nothing correct. And the other way around, It's all the time the same. No one hears anybody. And then it was incredible how this transboundary conflict affected all the economy and life of ordinary people. Incredible. I had all my life went to Argentina. I have friends in Argentina, but now is it, something is starting to change between like these two brother nations, and that it's also can be seen by in the governmental relationships. Like always, presidents from Argentina were all shaking hands all life, saying hello, my brother, blah 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 blah. And now it's like they don't talk. If they go to a summit in some place, all the press says, okay, they didn't want to talk, so one went on one door and the other one went on the other door, and they don't want to talk. And the foreign ministers are not doing, in my opinion, are not doing a very good job. And okay, and the other point, once started, this type of conflict is extremely difficult to settle. It's extremely difficult. And then an important thing is the need to strengthen bilateral institutional legal framework. We don't have now, I think that the solution is to have a local, not the international court, a local arbitration procedure that can be enforceable, because it cannot be that we have a Mercosur and that we have to go to the international court to settle this dispute. And the last one that I think also it's applicable to Uruguay is that governments need to try all and every possible bilateral negotiations before acting unilaterally. Okay, thank you very much. Have to clap.
Thank you, Juan Carlos, and I want to say a couple things. First, that the comment about the governments is also appropriate, that originally, back several months ago, we had invited official representatives of both governments, and you should know that both governments independently said they would not speak about the conflict, and even in a congenial setting like this one, so you understand how that gets. But we're very fortunate nonetheless to have a spokesperson from Argentina, although I should also say that we have set this up not at all as a debate and purposefully have not set it up that way. But I think it will still be interesting to see a little bit of the difference in perspective of what on some ways is a classic transboundary environmental conflict and in other ways a classic sort of modern sustainable development conflict as well. So with that, Eugenia.
Thank you. Well, first I want to say many things that I agree with Juan Carlos, that we also don't want to have this problem with Uruguay because of our good relation that we have always had. I want to tell you some things first about how is Argentina talking about environment. We can say nowadays that we have a rather good environmental law. It wasn't that way 12 or 14 years ago when I went back to start working on those issues. It was non-existent. So we have grown a lot on that field. Maybe we haven't been that good on enforcement, or we haven't been that good sometimes on environmental awareness, but we had two experiences in Argentina about environmental investments that they couldn't be done because of people reaction to them, and they were also two big projects that they had to do with natural resources. One of them was in the province of Tierra del Fuego in Ushuaia. It was a forestry project, and they had to stop it. And then there was another one in Patagonia. It was a project from Canada. It was about a gold mine, and also a big investment, and they couldn't do it. So this is not that new for us. We react about these things. We are having some exercise in that. So this is the first time this is a transboundary problem that David said. And we personally, what we think and with the lawyers I work, and well, what we think in Argentina, people don't like how we are managing this at the government level or the diplomatic level, because we could have done many other things before. Talking about an environmental project, we had other means to work on first and not to mix other problems, you know. And working on that field, you know that there are many, many things, many treaties and many things that you can do first. Okay. Well, I'm going out to... You can help me. Just this? Okay. Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I summarized some of main international principles that I think that are involved in this case, and so I'm not going to read them now. But first, obligation not to cause environmental harm. States must not use their territory or allow them to be used to cause environmental harm to a neighboring state. Two, environmental impact assessment in a transboundary context principle. Three, state responsibility principle. Four, the principle of prevention. Five, principle of prior notification. Okay. And UNEP's principle on shared natural resources. Principle 4 stated that should make environmental impact assessments before engaging in any activity with respect to shared natural resources which may create a risk of significantly affecting the environment of another state or states sharing that resource. And the World Bank principles that says that the bank expects the borrower to take into account the views of affected groups and local NGOs on the project's design and implementation, and in particular in the preparation of environmental impact assessments. It is important to understand the nature and extent of any social or environmental impact and the acceptability of proposed mitigatory measures, particularly to affected groups. Well, I want to tell you something very shortly about this forestry, because some technical aspects about it. Like, forestry produces timber. Timber is the raw material used by the pulp industry. The pulp industry, in turn, provides the raw material needed by the paper industry. Antecedents. Well, Uruguay developed an important forestry sector in the last two decades by means of a consistent state policy. Uruguay's forestry resources are mainly implanted, not native. The development of Uruguay's forestry sector implied the sacrifice of a part of the country's biodiversity and native forest. Argentina has a rather developed forestry sector. The most important Argentine forestry companies resort to implanted forests, not native forests. Argentina's native forests are also endangered, but not mainly by forestry projects. The main threats for the Argentine native forests are the expansion of agriculture, neglect, poor management, fires, diseases, and the use of food as fuel by large sectors of its population. The development of Uruguay's forestry sector caused the country to seek the development of value-adding activities in order to industrialize its timber production. Uruguay became an attractive place for investment for the pulp industry due to the availability of timber, Uruguay's investment-friendly environment, Uruguay's traditional respect for the rule of law. Argentina has a rather developed pulp and paper sector, with no less than 18 companies devoted to that industry. Despite some exceptions, most of the country's pulp and paper plants have outdated technology. So you can see that we cannot say that much, because our technology, the one we are having, are worse than these new ones that are proposed. Maybe not the best thing, but we are what? Uruguay River. The border between Argentina and Uruguay is the Uruguay River. Well, he saw a lot about this, but it's a wide river, but it's subject to periodic flow decreases, and that's a problem. That's an environmental problem. So, but that it could make it could pose a problem for this project. The use of the river is regulated by means of the Uruguay River Treaty, 1968, and Uruguay River Statute, 1975. The Uruguay River Treaty creates the joint obligation to prevent and fight water pollution, but does not prohibit the establishment of industries. The Uruguay River Treaty states that Uruguay and Argentina must notify each other any project that may cause water pollution. That was one thing that Uruguay failed on doing. They started the project, they gave the authorization for the project before doing this prior notification. And that's something that at a diplomatic level they are discussing now. The two cities, I think he talked very well about this. And the crisis. Well, the Gualeguay two people resented the construction of the two parliaments, fearing environmental damage resulting from the possible pollution of the Uruguay River, health damage resulting from possible polluting emissions, nuisance resulting from others, and negative visual impact on Gualeguay two beach over the Uruguay River. And by mid-2005, Gualeguay two's claim escalated into a community outbreak. Activists blockaded for the first time the bridge connected Gualeguay II with Fray Ventos. The governor of the Argentine province of Entre Ríos promoted other successive blockages. The Argentine government tolerated blockages of the three bridges connecting the two countries, rejected the International Finance Corporation environmental study supporting the Palmis, saying that it was defective and insufficient. The Argentine president stated that developed countries were using the region as a safe haven for their polluting industries. The Argentine government sued Uruguay before the International Court of Justice of The Hague, stated before the court that the Palmis would be polluting, said that Uruguay failed to notify the region of the Palmis as requested by the treaty. The Argentine government requested injunctive relief to the International Court of Justice in order to stop the construction of the pulp mills. The court rejected the Argentine request for injunctive relief and still considers the case. The Uruguayan government requested injunctive relief to the International Court of Justice in order to stop the bridge blockages. The court rejected the Uruguayan request, stating that no prejudice to the Uruguayan economy was evidenced. The court suggested Uruguay to resort to the Mercosur Tribunal. The actual situation. ENCE decided to relocate its project to the Uruguayan city of Punta Pereira. ENCE's decision was praised by the Argentine government. And Bolivia now announced that it would go on with the construction of its pipeline Fray Ventos and carry out production insights. Well, there are three technologies available for the pulp industry: chlorine technology, chlorine dioxide technology, and chlorine-free technology. The first one is very polluting. The second one is said to be, I don't know if it's absolutely true, but it's said to be environmentally friendly, but implies the most intense use of timber, and the products obtained through it has less demand. That's the other side. Okay. And the chlorine dioxide technology is in the middle, but is the world's most used in new pulp plants. Both NIA and ENCE will use this technology. Both pulp mills were designed present, that's what they say, the Uruguay and the company say, they were designed present to the best available techniques approved by the European Union. The Argentine Engineering Academy confirmed this fact. So because the Argentine Engineering Academy now are involved into the studies and are working together with Uruguayan technical people. By October 2007, all European pulp mills will have to comply with said techniques. Therefore, we We can say that it's not a transfer of outdated technology from developed countries to developing countries. The International Finance Corporation conducted two cumulative impact studies, December 2005 and April 2006, through independent consultants, including Argentine counterparts. The two IFC cumulative impact studies concluded that the environmental impact caused by the palm oil would be acceptable and within the limits of international standards. The chlorine dioxide technology was the best technology available for the project. Some technology improvement were suggested in the 2006 study. I want to say that when this process were approved, they hadn't their studies complete, so they did it after that. And that was something, well, they were reaching some international environmental treaties, as we saw before. No, these are the two things that we can say about this project from Uruguay's behavior. Okay. The Argentine Engineering Academy subscribed the conclusions of the cumulative impact studies carried out by IFC with regard to environmental impact and best technology available. That's the last thing we have from the technical part from Argentina. The Argentine Engineering Academy stated that the visual impact would be acceptable since Bonnie's Palmi would be 11 kilometers far from Gualeguaychú Beach and 27 kilometers far from the city. Okay. Bodnia may start its pulp production by mid-2008. Implications on international environmental law. As we said before, Uruguay failed to notify the project under the Uruguay River Treaty. Yet under the Uruguay River Treaty, neither Argentina nor Uruguay has a veto power to reject the neighboring country's investments. In case of disagreement regarding the occurrence of water pollution, the treaty provides for an appeal to International Court of Justice of the Hague. So something that I'm sure Argentina will use when the parliaments start working. I'm sure something they can do. Several environmental impact studies have concluded that environmental impact would be acceptable. The Uruguay River Treaty does not regulate visual impact, and environmental studies also dismiss such possibility. The Argentine Engineering Academy subscribes such conclusions. And the International Court of Justice is likely to issue a final judgment by 2009 or 2010. Bosnia failed also to recognize the Gualeguaychú peoples as stakeholder of the project and failed to consider its opinion when selecting the place for the construction of its pulp mill. Therefore, Bosnia failed to implement basic corporate social responsibility standards. Okay. The blockages of the bridges connecting Argentina and Uruguay are wrong and unacceptable. That's the bad part we are doing in Argentina. All Argentinian people don't like it. This is a government decision. It's something that are affecting much more the commerce from Argentina than Uruguay also. However, the Argentine government has chosen not to confront organized community claims due to the country's social situation. And the Argentine government's involvement in the conflict was reactive and politically driven. Okay. The long-standing fraternity between Argentina and Uruguay, as well as the bilateral relationship, has been damaged. Regional integration was also affected. The Mercosur Treaty is challenged by the palm oil dispute since it promotes regional integration and free commerce between its parties. The pulp mill dispute yielded some few direct benefits, yet such benefits do not compensate the harm. Okay. So this is something that we are trying to get something positive as things that are within our country. The protection of the environment is now in the Argentina public's public opinion's agenda. The Argentine government strengthened the environmental authority, which did not receive significant attention prior to the Palmis dispute. At the former government, it went from a ministry to undersecretariat. So now we have a ministry of the environment again. And so that's good, because the environmental issues are now again on the national agenda and the international agenda. Before they were non-existent, okay? The Argentine government has focused on other environmental tragedies affecting the country, such as the pollution in Riachuelo Basin, where millions of people live, and it's a really big environmental problem. It's the main we have. And the Argentine government has requested their country's pulp and paper sector to engage in a technology improvement program. Such technology improvement programs will also be implemented for other sectors of the industry. We have seen a great change in the media also, because environmental issues were not treated at all, and then started with the Palmis first in the first pages. Then there is always something there, but also they started to do some research on other environmental issues. And that's why there are some things that are going on. And well, that's a benefit. We can say that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eugenia. I think it's interesting, just as a note before Marco gets on, to think about how we often think about international legal problems as very organized and brought together in a nice package, but it's interesting to see how the local community organizing in both presentations has been such a driving force for pushing the national government's hands in a way that they end up having to react. And it's a reminder, I think, about how often environmental issues have a much more important and profound impact on the local communities, and they may make it a much higher priority for them than it would be otherwise for the national governments. And typically that is where it ends, but in this case, because of the continuing community organizing, it seems like it's driven the federal government into taking action in Argentina and driven this impact on both sides, which I think is an aspect we don't always look at. And I'd also thought it was very interesting to think about the implications of this dispute beyond the traditional environmental aspects into the other impacts between the relationship between Argentina and Uruguay, and even Argentina's domestic environmental issues. And the last thing I'd like to note before I hand over the microphone to Marcos is that it should be noted that the new Argentine environment minister is also a graduate of the LLM program. Here, Romina Piccolotti, and she's, I think, a graduate from around 1998-99 or something like that. So it's also an indication of the program's reach. Marcos? I have the lights back on. Yes.
Thank you, David, for that introduction and for the invitation to participate in this celebration. It's a real joy to see old friends, football, soccer, teammates, professors and students and friends and colleagues. And at the Center for International Environmental Law, we got involved in this case on request of SEIDA's David described. SEIDA was planning at the time a couple of years ago, and it actually filed a petition before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on behalf of the potentially affected people in the Argentine side of the river. So we started looking at this case, and some of the comments that I make today may be colored by that exercise, and also by some of the regional implications, given that I'm a national of Chile, and this case has some regional impacts. In the few minutes that I have today, I was planning to describe some of the cases, the two or three decisions that have come out so far, both from the Mercosur Arbitral Tribunal as well as from the International Court of Justice. This will be a descriptive exercise to gain sort of a baseline information of the cases and then offer some comments on those decisions, on the way that those tribunals have approached the legal issues that have come before them. So jumping right into that, the Mercosur Arbitral Tribunal had to deal, as we already know, with the following basic facts. Citizens, mainly in Argentina, impeded the free circulation of free movement of goods and services from Argentina to Uruguay. Several bridges, not just one, sporadically and also more permanently, 3 months duration in the summer of 2006. These were the facts before the tribunal. Another relevant fact is that Argentina called for an end of the restrictions but did not resort to the public force to put an end to those manifestations, and I'll come back to why Argentina resorted to that or took that attitude. So the claim by Uruguay is that this Argentina is responsible for failure to comply with its obligations established under the Mercosur legal framework. And what it asked the tribunal to do was to order guarantees of non-repetition, so declaratory judgment and guarantees of non-repetition. Argentina mounted a very interesting defense, mainly on 3 points. Interesting because it brought non-Mercosur law into the mix. Before that, let me just say that Argentina also argued that the restrictions on the free circulation of goods and services were announced, so economic operators had the chance to take alternative routes. Second, and I think this is the interesting part, I think, is that Argentina argued that the protests were the exercise of legitimate human rights, that the citizens that potentially were affected by the pollution caused by these plants, or to be caused, if any, had the legitimate right of expression, the legitimate right of assembly, and the legitimate right to protest. And these rights took priority over Mercosur legal framework and the free circulation of goods. This argument probably must be read to in the broader context of the Argentine situation, where the economic crisis has led to manifestations on the streets and the government has taken an attitude that these are legitimate rights of protests. And third, and the last argument in the defense was that Argentina really had no other option because than to tolerate the blockades, because otherwise it would have had to resort to unacceptable repression by the police, which a democratic government was not prepared to do. The decision of the tribunal, 21 June 06, so last year, concluded one, that Argentina failed to comply with its Mercosur obligations. Even though the blockades were perpetrated, would be a strong word, by independent parties, third parties, Argentina was responsible for its own omissions, for the due diligence that it had to exercise to prevent the blockades. These are categories in international law responsibility that are not completely novel. What is again interesting in this decision is that the tribunal in relation to Argentina's defense said that human rights were not absolute. They were limited by the rights of others, or their exercise was limited to the respect of the rights of others. And the tribunal also said that Argentina could have taken certain measures to deal with the blockades, such as regulating the timing of the protests or the place of the protests, so that there could be a balance between the freedom of expression and assembly and the free circulation of goods. And as we've heard, and the final point of the decision is that it was a declaratory judgment, and the tribunal felt that it was not empowered to issue an order or an indication of guarantees of non-repetition attaching to future conduct. So a couple of comments on this decision. First, as we know, the increasing fragmentation of the legal order has meant that proliferating in the dispute settlement fora are hearing similar cases or the same case based on different causes of action stemming from different legal sources or treaties. In this case, we have a Mercosur trade tribunal interpreting human rights law, and there are some there's language in the award where the tribunal says we have to be careful with this task because we don't want to exceed our jurisdictional competence. So you can see that the tribunal was aware of the difficulty in establishing this dialogue between trade law on the one hand and human rights law on the other. Then in relation to human rights as a defense, the approach taken by the tribunal was that human rights was external to Mercosur law. Now, this may contrast perhaps with the approach taken in the European Union context, where human rights have been deemed to be an integral part of the public legal order of the Union. It's not something external to Mercosur, but something that provides a sustenance, a pillar. And second, in regards to this defense, the tribunal noted that balancing human rights and trade rights could justify restrictions, but not the total exclusion of the value considered less important. In the facts of the case, the government could have, or the tribunal could have considered that the rights to assembly and freedom of expression could justify restrictions on freedom of transit, etc., but they could not completely exclude it. Now, this approach, while it may sound philosophically interesting and it's worded sort of as a philosophy exercise in the award, in my view, it's the wrong approach. It cannot be right, because if it is right, then, for example, France cannot take a measure banning asbestos products into its territory from Canada, which was upheld to be legitimate by the WTO's, the World Trade Organization's appellate body. For in the same vein, no country could ever take a measure restricting access of any product to its territory that it deems necessary for the protection of public health, because that would put a blockade on the entry of a product, so a total restriction on the exercise of a right and not just a diminution. That would be the idea there. A third comment, and this relates to the regional perspective, is that Uruguay in those proceedings had used considerable evidence on the economic injury it had suffered and it was suffering as a result of the blockade of the bridges. The tribunal considered this evidence to be relevant in the determination of legal interest to bring the action. Now again, in the WTO, this approach has not been adopted. It has followed more of a public order where the breach of an obligation leads to a legal interest, and it is not necessary to adduce evidence of economic injury resulting from that. So this is relevant, I think, for Mercosur in general. Evidence of economic injury may, of course, be relevant in relation to countermeasures or otherwise that the tribunal may have considered, but it did not go in that route. And finally, the tribunal noted that its mission was to, and I quote, defend, end of quote, Mercosur's legal framework, and to legitimize restrictions would undermine the development of Mercosur. This approach also reminds me of the multilateral trading system in the early 90s, where policy outcomes were driving the content of decisions rather than considerations concerning the facts and the application of the law. So with those comments, perhaps I could jump right on to look at the ICJ's decisions on provisional measures. This case was brought on the merits by Argentina against Uruguay for what it claims is a violation of the 1975 statute governing the Uruguay River. According to Argentina, and these are its claims, the breach, the violation of the statute is found in the frustration of the optimum and rational utilization of the River Uruguay, and it substantiates its claims by analyzing certain breaches of violations, and it divides those breaches between procedural obligations and substantive obligations. In the procedural context, it argues or claims that Uruguay has failed to provide prior notification to Argentina on a work that has significant transboundary impact as required by the Uruguay statute, the Uruguay River statute, I'm sorry. It has failed to conduct an appropriate and adequate environmental impact assessment. It has failed to cooperate with the other riparian state. And in terms of substance, Argentina claims that Uruguay, by authorizing and proceeding with the construction of the plants, is failing to preserve the environment, to prevent pollution, and to protect biodiversity and fisheries. So on this basis, this on the merits, it sought from the ICJ an order for provisional measures requesting the suspension of the authorizations and the building work. Uruguay, on its hand, on the merits, says that it has complied fully with the 1975 statute, which it argues provides no right of veto of any party over projects of the other in their own territories, that it has applied the highest international standards that we've heard in the presentations before, enforced or to be enforced in the European Union later on this year. It has provided the technical data to Argentina that relates to this case. And it has elaborated an environmental impact assessment that shows no harm to the Uruguay River. And so on its own, Uruguay requested the ICJ to prevent or put an end to the blockaging of the bridges and the roads in different times. I mean, I'm conflating these for the ease of narrative. What did the ICJ decide? Well, the ICJ first, it underscored its power to preserve the rights of each party pending the final decision. It reminded us of the threshold to exercise that power, which it understood to be the urgent necessity to prevent irreparable prejudice to the rights in question. What was its decision on suspension? Well, number one, the procedural rights that Argentina claimed can be remedied at the merit stage. Second, Argentina has not provided evidence suggesting that pollution from the mills would cause irreparable harm to the River Uruguay. Now, this word suggesting is taken from the decision, and it's quite a strong word given that, given the hearings, all the evidence that was submitted, but I'll get to the comments in a bit. It also held that the threat of pollution is not imminent, as the plants will may be in operation later on this year or the next. Another statement of the ICJ, which is relevant and I'll come back to in my comments, is that in proceeding with the authorization and the construction of the mills, the ICJ said, Uruguay necessarily bears with all the risks associated to findings on the merits. So this question of risk, I'll come back to that when we look at the, when I look at the bilateral investment treaties in force. 5 minutes, okay. And finally, in terms of remedies, the court did not exclude that the works could be discontinued, the possibility that the works be discontinued, modified, or dismantled. There was a dissenting opinion by Judge Vinuesa from Argentina, the party-appointed judge, who noted that, that Argentina had proved a reasonable basis, had generated a reasonable basis of uncertainty on the probable negative impacts on the environment of the river. And based on that, and applying the precautionary principle, it voted, it dissented from the majority and would have been of the opinion to grant a suspension on the works. And the decision on the bridges by the ICJ was that given that the construction of the plant had continued during the, despite the blockades, then there was no evidence of an urgent and imminent threat to the rights to, of Uruguay to construct the plants. So let me conclude in the final 4 minutes with a couple of comments. First, that this case shows that the multiple forums that not only civil society but governments can also bring these the legal action. The ICJ, Mercosur, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the International Finance Corporation has been involved, the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, export credit agencies in Finland, etc. Then there is the question, these are scattered comments, I'll apologize in advance. There's the question of how does the court determine whether it has prima facie jurisdiction when it is entertaining a request for provisional measures. Is it a question of assuming the legitimacy of the rights as claimed, or does the court need to engage in a preliminary, minimal, some kind of review on the legitimacy of such rights? This question gave rise to separate opinions by several judges. Then there's the question of the jurisdiction of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to hear a petition by those directly affected. There's 2 points here. If the ICJ is exercising jurisdiction also on the human rights aspects of the case, and this is a question mark because it is not clear that under the 1975 statute or under International Water Courses law, human rights are encompassed. Well, if the ICJ does exercise jurisdiction, then Uruguay, as a defense in before the commission, could argue that the proceedings are being entertained by another international forum, and thus the petition would not be admissible before the commission, and vice versa. If there's no jurisdiction of the ICJ on this question, well, then it may be that the commission hears this complaint. Now, the more interesting question of risk. The ICJ says that Uruguay necessarily bears all the risks associated to findings on the merits. Well, does this mean that the investor, the Finnish company or the Spanish company, bears no risk on associated to the plans? What is the position of bilateral investment treaties in this regard? Do they operate as an insurance policy? It has often been noted that in order to receive international protection under these treaties, a project needs to comply with internal domestic law, which allegedly it does in this case. Does it also need to comply with international law, public international law? If the ICJ orders the dismantling of the plants, would Uruguay bear all the risks associated to that? Would the investor obtain compensation on the theory that its legitimate expectations to a profit have been frustrated? These are questions that are left open. Would there be a question of complicity between the investor and the host state? Would there be a question of the application of the doctrine of estoppel, where Uruguay would be precluded from raising any of these defenses because it had, by its prior conduct, given way to the problem? Another question is concerns the responsibility of international financial institutions. As we've heard, the IFC was involved at the time. At the time it was considering the project, it had not yet conducted a cumulative impact assessment. As we know, human rights law imposes the obligation on states to conduct an environmental assessment, and when projects are financed by international financial institutions, the states may argue, host states may argue that they are complying, discharging their obligations by taking into account the environmental impact assessments conducted by the IFI. Now, what does that mean for the responsibility of the IFI if the EIA is deficient and there is injury caused to local populations, which, as we know, the plants have not yet been commissioned, so it's a hypothetical. Two more things. At some point, it seemed that this was a dispute that put law on the one hand and science on the other hand. There was an investment with numbers, certain. There was potential environmental harm, uncertain. There are questions of the quality of the EIA, potential pollution, what are the applicable standards. the technical standards. Is there any role for the precautionary principle, and what is it? And finally, the ICJ says that it may order the plants to be dismantled if they actually breach the 1975 statute. One is only left to wonder how realistic is it for the plants to be dismantled, given that this is the largest investment in Uruguay's history. So back to my CL hat, it seems that this case is pretty much over. And with that, thank you very much.
About 10 minutes. Thank you, Marcos. We'll open the floor for questions. We started a little late, so we'll go a few minutes late if there are questions. How do we do that, Sweeney? Do we have a? I guess we have two microphones, and people can come up to the microphone. While I'm waiting, I'll pose two quick questions. One, and this may be for Marcos, but it may be for either of the others as well. Can we read anything about the ultimate substantive outcome of the court, other than that the remedy may not be to dismantle, but can we read anything about how the court will view the different substantive legal arguments from the two decisions on injunctive relief that we've seen? That's my first question. And the second question, which I think is for everyone, is that, and I think Juan Carlos presented this as well, that to some extent this case reflects an institutional breakdown in the ability to resolve a transboundary environmental conflict, that the reliance on a treaty that I'll note was signed well before the concept of sustainable development or of integration of environmental concerns would have been at the forefront of a bilateral river agreement, and that the only that the formal reliance goes either to this fairly old, not that old, but pre-environmental at least, bilateral agreement, or all the way to the Hague, and there seems to be nothing less wieldy other than perhaps informal negotiations to deal with it. Do we, for example, need to think about the role of the OAS or of some other organization? And of course, Mercosur wades in, but with this perspective on trade, as you already pointed out, that may also be suboptimal. So what would be the suggestions or comments for an institutional response to strengthen the ability to avoid and respond to this kind of transboundary conflict in advance? So those would be two questions.
Should I take the first one?
Yeah.
These microphones are hard to use. Whether the decisions on provisional measures will affect the decision on the merits?
Whether we have any indication of what the court might be thinking?
Well, I think that the answer is no. We don't have an indication so far, and it is not common that there are those indications, that those indications will become available. It is also, at least legally, there's no binding effect of provisional measures on the court itself in terms of its decision on the merits. Now, there has been some debate on whether decisions or judgment, the orders of provisional measures are binding on the parties, and it seems that after recent precedent, Lagrand case and others, the ICJ is considering them binding and can attach state responsibility for failure to abide by them. But it does not mean that they prejudge the decision on the merits. So in terms of the decision of the merits, there are both the procedural issues and the substantive issues. And in terms of the procedural issues, did Uruguay notify Argentina? Did Uruguay conduct an EIA? Did Uruguay cooperate with Argentina? It seems that in this context, it's very hard to ascertain which of the two countries is failing to cooperate. There will be a lot of data to be analyzed, but when these cases come about, it's because the two countries cannot come together, even when in this case there is already an institutional machinery to bring the two cases together, which if there weren't, then the ICJ might have been inclined to say, well, both countries, in light of the potential environmental damage, engage, which according to customary law is the UN International Law Commission has codified these principles. And then in terms of the substance, as long as the plants are not in operation, it will be impossible to tell whether the pollution will affect the rights of the riparian. And even when it is in operation, the administrative structure to deal with the river might be responsible to deal with that situation. So it's there's no indications, and we'll have to wait and see.
Comments on the institutional question?
Something is going very wrong in from an institutional point of view. It's not possible that first the commission that runs the river cannot get into an arrangement. Then on a diplomatic basis there's no arrangement, and then you go to the Mercosur and there's no arrangement there either. Something is very bad. So Uruguay went also to the OAS last year, but it's kind of an administrative process that it's not an arbitration procedure. It's more a political procedure, so it will take a lot of time, and I don't know what is going to be the outcome. And so Argentina, I think that they did what they could. Is going to the international court because they cannot do anything else. And Uruguay did what it did, going to the Mercosur, there's no chance there. So I think your question is a very interesting question. What can we do? I was telling in the presentation that our best choice is King Juan Carlos mediation. That's not a very good perspective if you want to have a solution on the long run. So we have a problem.
Exactly. I agree with him, and as far as I know, our president, he's very tough on this type of decisions, and he takes these things very personally. So that's why he's so stubborn in this. So that's it's just like he says.
Okay. Can I add something? I think one problem here was the lack of information. Although Argentina says, you didn't give me the information, Uruguay says, I gave you the information. But the thing is that the governments have to talk before things happen, not after, at every level. I don't know, maybe if you want the ministries and the specific people that work in the commission, but they all have to know everything before, because if not, we both lose. It's not a thing of saying, okay, I'm not going to tell you the investment because the investment is coming to Uruguay and I don't want to tell you. Look what happened. This was a lesson for Uruguay, I suppose.
But the same thing happened in Argentina, that these two projects that they couldn't do before, it was one of the big things, big mistakes they did is they didn't inform to people. They have to talk about the project and to talk at a broad level that everybody understands. If not, then you just can't manage any information, and you can't manage the media, anything. And it's very common that this project come in that way without saying anything, and that's how people react.
Yes, my name is Deborah McCormick. I'm an LLM student here, and I'm from Canada, and so I must say I'm very proud of you for saying no to the gold mine if it's going to pollute your waters and your air, and I think Canadian people would feel that way too. And secondly, I thought that not to detract from Uruguay's needs. I understand those, of course, too. But I thought that the campaign was brilliant, and I love this Miss Carnival Queen up there doing her thing. And I'm just wondering how. You seem to have such wonderful wonderful support. How does the country get so well organized and so effectively, you know, tried to put the kibosh on this thing. I was really impressed with that too, that they had daily meetings, as you said, and they had so many bodies there. I was really impressed with that. So maybe you could comment on that.
No, well, maybe I'm sure he can answer it better, because they were supported by many groups, like human rights groups, and they have support from the governments, from provincial government and from the national government also. But I think he knows more about that.
Well, I want to add not so much how it happened, but that it may not be that rare if we think about some of the response to investment in Bolivia. Over some of the water and other issues, this idea of one way to think about this is the role of a local community. Now, again, this has this transboundary gloss over it, but for the community living right over the bridge in Argentina, I don't think I think it's a sincere form of protest that they're concerned about the pollution that's going to come from these very large industries. And so I think we've seen in several different examples now the local activism of a community rejecting either a federal plan for approval of foreign investment, or in this case, a transnational approval of plan. But we've seen similar things, I think, in Peru and in Bolivia in this hemisphere. And I think that's part of the new nature of addressing foreign investment in large projects that have significant environmental and human rights implications, is that it may no longer be sufficient to deal at the national level with the national ministries, that this idea of information that both Juan Carlos and Eugenia were talking about, the need to deliver information to the local communities, made even more difficult in this case by the transboundary context, but that's, it seems to me, that we're seeing that lesson in many different types of investment, that local communities are getting empowered through their ability to connect with international fora, international lawyers and activists like Marcos at CL and others, and that this is changing the geography of international investment law and the constraints that face investors.
One more question?
Mm-hmm. My comment is, first of all,
you have a question?
No.
Okay. Your name too, please.
Is it better?
Yeah.
Okay. One thing that makes law very interesting is that how it evolves during the time based on needs. And I think this is one of those cases that you would see is not just one country that's been affected by a new corporation or investment, but two countries. And maybe it's now time to set the rules for going after corporations instead of, in this case, as you can see, two countries are fighting over rules and statutes and treaties that exist already with each other. But those corporations, they actually are just doing whatever they were doing before anyway. So, I think the main thing is, after all this, like, international investments, trades, and all of that, and like all these companies are going into different countries for investment. There should be some way for holding them responsible. Like if Argentina, for example, knows if anything goes wrong, they can go after those corporations. They wouldn't have been fighting with Uruguay at this point, because they know they can hold those companies responsible. And I think it's kind of not fair to neither of these two countries to go after for these fights, and when the other the corporations are actually not being even affected by it.
Mm-hmm. Your name and where you're from?
I'm Parva. I'm an ILSP student, and I'm from Iran.
I'll make one. If I may, I'll make a comment. No, I think that's a very good point, and one of the interesting things about this case in a broader context, in addition to the conflict between the states, is it does, I think, highlight the difficulty bringing accountability in a transboundary context with foreign investors. And there have been strategies, but we all would know the limitations. So the communities did explore filing suit against the companies in Argentina difficulties perhaps with jurisdiction. They considered whether they would have jurisdiction or standing to bring a case in Uruguay. They also brought claims to relate to the financial side of the investment. So bringing claims, and Marcos mentioned these with respect to the IFC, the OECD, and the Export Credit Agencies. So at the same time that we have a public international law conflict, we also, I think, see playing out this tension between between foreign investment and the local communities, and using new forms of international mechanisms, at least to address this.
On that question, both governments in the proceedings that took place at the ICJ and at Mercosur, they both agreed that environmental protection was important. Then both governments also agreed on the need for sustainable development and the role of foreign direct investment in that process. So there's not the classic, as it wants to be framed, tension between investment versus environment, and the title of the panel is Investment and Environment. So how does this relate to your question? It relates to the fact that any accountability in this case is hard to establish ex ante because the plans have not been yet commissioned. So because it's a prospective, and the investment is in the making and the plans are not yet in operation, you will be hard-pressed to find somebody that has been affected. So then the question is, well, how do we ensure prevention? And it seems that the states have a role in that, and the public order and international treaties can be designed to do that. That is not to say that liability of transnational corporations is not a relevant issue, but it seems that the timing of the development of the project means that if there is any liability, that will come afterwards when damage can be established and through evidence, via evidence. And this seems to be the problem in this case, that there's no evidence yet.
It's a problem with every environmental case. We have to wait till we get poisoned before we can bring the case. Go ahead. I'll let you.
I have
two more questions. Yours?
One question. My name is Jose Pablo Sanchez. I'm from Costa Rica, and I'm an LLM student. My question is regarding something that Marcos already said. The dispute is regarding the rights and duties concerning the 1975 treaty between Uruguay and Argentina. And the treaty established that there must be notification and the duty of consult. However, it doesn't say that there must be consent from Argentina in order to develop any activity there. So what will be, as it seems, the public participation has been done in the Argentinian side. How is it relevant for Uruguay, since public participation is part of the environmental impact assessment in domestic law, and how these public participation or activities from Argentina will relate to Uruguay?
Right. Your question puts the emphasis on a deficiency that can be found in several legal or internal laws of several countries, and it relates to questions of transboundary nature or cumulative impacts. In cases of transboundary potential transboundary pollution, and I think you were raising this, and you too. The law is evolving, but the recent articles adopted by the International Law Commission call for parties to involve in the public participation communities in both sides, in both countries. Mm-hmm. Now, why is this important? Well, because perspectives will be considered and better solutions may be arrived at to deal with issues besides the whole prevention of conflict. Now, that being best practice or requirement at international law, it is not always the case that that is translated or introduced, incorporated into the internal legal framework of the countries that are involved. And in this case, because the project is taking its place fully within Uruguay territory, then Uruguay law controls. Now, to the extent that Uruguayan law does not comport or conform to its international standards, there may be a question of international responsibility, but it is on a procedural level and it will be addressed on the merits maybe a year from now or two.
Okay.
My name is Svena Francisco, and I'm from Curaçao.
Oh, wait, can I stop you right there?
Of course.
Normally I don't interrupt a questioner, but Svena has also been the person who's been helping us put together this panel and making sure that everything worked today, so I'd like to give her a hand before she... And I'm sure it'll be a very good question. Go ahead.
Thank you. My question was actually similar to Parva's question, so I'm going to change it a little bit and just ask you for your comments. It's regarding the accountability of the corporations. And since accountability is a difficult question or difficult, you know, a difficult solution for their accountability, maybe we can take it a step further and look at the European Union and what, for example, Argentina or the Argentinian people, the assembly can do there. Like Ms. Beck mentioned, in the European Union, there's like a directive to which all the corporations must apply if they do a paper mill case or if they do like some environmental impact project. Maybe you can look at the domestic legislation of Finland or Spain, file a petition, and you go to the European Commission and you see what the outcome might be. That's also in a way, I think, to go somewhere and to hold the corporations responsible. I don't know what your comments might be on that.
Okay. Private international law. I'm not an expert on that. But, no, I think it's. I think that's something that Argentina is going to explore that possibility for sure. And I. But I don't know. Again, if this is the right moment to do it, because as now Argentina cannot prove any damage at this moment. So I think it's something that Argentina is going to. To take steps some time from now, yes, but we have to look after that very well. That's true.
Some things they are doing, because there are protests once in a while on the Finnish embassy in Argentina, yeah. And also in the Spanish embassy in Buenos Aires. So, but I don't know why
from
they.
From a legal point of view.
Yes, from a legal point of view, I really don't know. Yes. What will happen?
Yeah.
The not so much the states, but the community has filed, or at least is considered filing, but I believe they filed with the OECD national contact points for the investing countries. So for Finland and Spain. So that's bringing it back to the host country. And so the question of whether one could find a way to bring a suit invoking the European institutions, it's another set of fora you have standing and other issues. But I think it's creative and interesting, and also reflects part of the process that's going on that Marcos alluded to about the search for forums. And you now have more than just the government searching for them. So we see these different fora being used because the community itself is looking for handles of accountability. And so as we ask this question of accountability of the companies, the first question is accountability to whom? And that question is being answered not only accountability to the government of Uruguay or of the government of Argentina, but also accountability to the affected community, and they're looking for a different set of fora, either the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, or perhaps looking to see if they have leverage in the European Union would be another strategy for them. And they may feel less diplomatically tied than the government. So I think we see more and more of this kind of forum, multiple forum shopping and multiple use of forums in these kind of investment cases. You get the last question.
My name is Mariano Wolf. I'm from Argentina, LLM 1999. First of all, I want to congratulate all of you guys. Did a terrific job. It's a very difficult issue. Also, I want to disagree a little bit with the Canadian girl. If you go to Wally 2, there is nothing that organized there. Many people there, they don't even know what they are doing. And they don't know even what they are meeting. And it's a mess there. They are not organized. You go there, you don't know when it's blocked, when it's not, when you can come in, when you cannot. Sometimes you are waiting 14 hours just to cross from one bridge to the other, one side to the other. It's a big mess. My question is, as far as I remember, one of the slides, Juan, ENCE was granted the permit in 2003, and then Bosnia was in 2005. But the one that is extremely very well developed is the Bosnia one. and seems like it was built really, really fast. My question is, if it was granted the first one to the Spain and they hold, why didn't they hold for the Bosnia one instead of going to all these big bilateral... Start building so fast instead of waiting or probably relocate to a more convenient place?
The thing was that it's a corporate decision. So Bosnia decided to go ahead, although they had the risk, as Falco says, of not doing the plan, but they decided to do it. And when all, I think that there is something related, I believe, because the Spanish connection with Uruguay and Argentina has something to do. So at one point, I think Kirchner talked with Zapatero, no? We talked with the Spaniard Prime Minister, and there I remember the ENCE general manager came to Uruguay, went to Buenos Aires also, and he said, the press said any kind of things, but he said that they were going to relocate, that they were going to stop the investment, many things there was. So ENCE was like 1 year, like stopped all the plan. They didn't know what they were going to do, and they just released like they said that they were going to do it again, like what, 2-3 months ago, something like that, with the new place relocating. So as she said, the impact of the environmentalists was very, very, very great, and
successful,
yes, and one of the best achievements was the relocation of the pollution is going to be exactly the same, but if there is pollution, it's going to be exactly the same. But at least it's in an open place and it's not beside Gualeguaychú.
It's further away from the community.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is.
So Uruguay will face more of the pollution than
Argentina.
For sure.
Yes, because there is a big, but it's an important Uruguayan city. Downstream of the new location, but obviously the government now cannot say anything, as you can imagine.
Now they don't want to build. Right? Excellent. All right. Any last comments anybody wants to make? Then I think it's only yes one. I was only asking them, but no, go ahead. Yeah.
My name is Mariana Loza. I'm also from Argentina. I have a question for Marcos. The understanding that CIALS is supporting is against the pulp mills, right? Or it's supporting the people, just saying. Keep putting it simple. Is that right?
CL's mission is the protection of human rights and environment.
Okay, and in this matter, it's against the construction of... And in this case, it's against the construction of the pulp mills.
I can offer you a perspective in that it seems that the big issue in this case is the location of the plant. It doesn't seem to be so much a question of whether the plant is good or bad, the technology. There was an issue with the EIA as it was conducted. And if the communities had been consulted, maybe the governments would have come to the realization that that was not the best spot, given the dynamics of the ecosystem and the communities that could be affected.
On the one hand, we had that the World Bank provided some loans so the companies could finish the projects. And before providing and approving the loan, they made an analysis and they said that there was not going to be a negative impact or damage that cannot be repaired. And then on the other side, you have the Gualeguaychú Committee and many NGOs that seems not to be seem not to agree with, or to be against that with the analysis of the World Bank. So, it's like a contradiction that the World Bank that is supposed to have the same goals, or at least in environmental issues, as many of the NGOs that protect the environment. So that was why I was asking the position of CLS in this particular.
Yes. Yeah. There is an apparent contradiction, but I would note that the World Bank does not always abide by its safeguard policies, unfortunately, and the quality of its environmental impact assessments are not always up to what it should be doing. This is confirmed by the evaluations within the bank. In this particular case, there was a complaint lodged with the IFC's ombudsman because the EIA that was conducted was deficient in the opinion of the affected populations. The ombudsman validated that complaint, and after that, the IFC conducted a cumulative impact assessment. When we have that development, one can see that the technical adequacy of the EIA, raises questions. Now, after the cumulative impact assessment is concluded, and the conclusions, as we've heard, are that it utilizes best available technology, that pollution is within acceptable standards, etc., then what is the position of the organization, CL? Well, I can speak for CL only, is that we're lawyers and not scientists, so we would have to go to make our own measurements and to dispute that finding, which we cannot do, of course. But so, that's where the perspective comes from. But from the perspective of the affected community, it seems wholly legitimate to have questions given this development on whether the plants, once operational, will produce pollution that will affect people's lives, and not just the quality of life, but dioxins that can compromise health and life. So that, in terms of a concern, seems to be legitimate, even when you have these findings on pollution and standards. One final point is that the report, the EIA, as it currently exists, does not say that there will not be pollution. It says that the pollution will conform to applicable standards. Now, what standards are those? Are they sufficiently strict to ensure the rights of the population, the right to life, the right to health? Well, that is something that we need to wait and see.
Excellent. Well, I want to take this moment to thank all the panelists, particularly those who have come quite a ways to be here, and to thank all of you, particularly for staying late to be here for you. So we'll give everybody a round of applause.
Thank you.
And there's one more thing, a reminder for the bus. Suena.
Yeah, everyone who's going to the reception tonight, there are 3 buses leaving. From the law school to the Winston & Strah law firm, and they're leaving in front of the law school at 6, 2 buses, and at 6:30 the last one. Okay.